I don't really... She pulled herself in close, almost nose to nose. She wasn't smiling, and he wasn't either. I didn't ask if you wanted to talk. I said, I need to know. Whatever ship I'm the captain of, if you're on it, that means you and I have clear, open, and honest conversations about your mental health. This isn't friendship. This isn't nurturing. This is me telling you how it goes. We both know what happens when you're off the rails, and I'm not going to pretend that you're anything more or less than what you are. So when I say I need to know if you're okay, it's an order. Are we clear? Amos's jaw clenched, and his eyes went flat. She didn't back away. When he smiled, it wasn't the empty, amiable expression he usually reached for. It wasn't a version of him she'd seen before. I'm sad, Babs. I'm angry, but I'm okay. Going down fighting was a good way for her to go, too. I can live with it. Bobby let herself drift back. Her heart was going a little faster than she liked, but she kept it off her face. All right, then. Take your team and go through the ship. I'll warn you when we're going on the burn. I'm on it, Amos said. And a moment later, you know, you're going to be good at this captain thing. Chapter 50. Sing. This is exactly the kind of recklessness that has been underlying the transport union since its inception, Carrie Fisk said. Her face was flushed, her gestures sharp, and her voice had the buzz of rage behind every word. Her blouse was tan with black, and she wore the green armband that had come to symbolize anti-terrorist solidarity among those loyal to Laconia and High Consul Duarte. The Union claimed that stability and safety were their primary mandate. That was the whole point of letting it administrate Ringspace. But the minute someone arrives with the power to question that, bombings, theft, murder, the hypocrisy is mind-boggling. It's unreal. The interviewer was a young man apparently well-known in Sol's system and on Medina. Singh watched the man nod and stroke his chin like an ancient sage considering a deep, mystical truth. His seriousness made Fisk look even more formidable. "And would you say the situation is stabilized now?" he asked. "We can hope it is," Fisk said as she shook her head no. "When I look at the patience that the present administration has shown to us, and the violence with which it was answered, it leaves me, not angry even, embarrassed. We called ourselves a civilization, and this thuggery is all we have to offer. I can only hope that the people who were fooled into thinking any of this could be justified are embarrassed too." It was a sentence Singh had written himself and delivered to Fisk. She repeated it now, as if it were an off-the-cuff thought, and she made it sound mostly convincing. Of all the things he had done since he'd come to Medina, Fisk and the Laconian Congress of Worlds was by far the most successful. Everything else, moving up the timetable for the Tempest's transit to Sol system, flushing out the underground, managing Medina Station, was tainted. The catastrophe had lasted 5¾ hours from the launch of James Holden's ship to the restoration of full function to Medina Station. In that time, his best informant and the team sent to back him had been slaughtered. The station's external sensors had been compromised, the Laconian Marine forces neutralized, the detention centers broken open, and 52 prisoners lost and not yet recovered. 20 Union ships had transited through no one knew which gate or gates, and the gathering storm had been boarded and hijacked. It was, without exception, the greatest failure of security Singh had ever heard of, And as governor of Medina Station, he had spent almost the whole time hiding in a public toilet. Humiliation sat in his belly like a stone, and he had the distinct sense that it would remain there forever. Every decision he had made since he'd arrived at Medina returned to him in the light of his failure, and he considered each of them like a wound in his skin. If he had treated the local population with greater caution from the first, would Kasich have lived? If he had chosen to respond to the assassination attempt with a more focused response, would the underground have gained fewer followers and allies? If he had avoided the confusion of restructuring his security forces by retaining Tanaka, would they have exposed the underground in time to prevent this? The list seemed to go on forever. And each choice he'd made, sending the storm out despite Davenport warning him it was undercrewed, shipping James Holden to Laconia instead of questioning him more deeply about the underground, encouraging Trejo and the Tempest to move the timetable forward for the transit into Sol System, had led him here. So, on some level, each of them had been wrong. No matter how wise they had seemed at the time, how forgivable and subtle his failures of judgment had been, the final evidence was unmistakable. He had treated the people of Medina as though he were their leader, instead of their warden, instead of their zookeeper. And they had paid him back with violence, death, and dishonor. All of that was a given now. There was no standing apart from the failure. It had happened on his watch, and so it was his problem to fix. And it didn't apply only to Medina. He saw that now. His mandate was to coordinate the Empire from this, its hub. And that would mean crushing the underground, wherever it had fled. Wherever it emerged from the fresh dung heap of the Union's demise. He'd thought of Medina as a station to run, a logistical heart to sustain the glorious future for humanity. He'd been mistaken. His system chirped a connection request. He checked himself in the monitor, smoothed his hair, and straightened his tunic. He was done looking less than knife-sharp. These were, after all, the first days of his career's rehabilitation. He accepted the request. A woman's face appeared on the screen, a small identifier hovering above her to say who and what she was to him. "Lieutenant Guillemet," he said crisply. "Rear Admiral Song of the Eye of the Typhoon is requesting command to command, Governor." "Of course," he said. The monitor flickered. He straightened his tunic again and felt immediately self-conscious that he'd done it. It was a sign of insecurity, even if he was the only one who knew about it. Rear Admiral Song appeared. Her wide mouth was set in a polite smile. The light delay was almost trivial. Evidence that the typhoon was on track to pass through the gate. "Governor Singh," she said, "it's good to see you."
"Likewise," he replied.
"We're on approach to the ring gate," Song said, then looked away. "I'm very sorry, but given everything that's happened recently, I have to ask you this. Can you assure me that this transit is safe?" Singh settled more deeply into his couch. "Of course it is," floated at the back of his mouth. "The typhoon can come through the gate, and there won't be any rogue ship zipping through some other gate in the seconds before to change the safety curve. You and your crew will survive the trip and take its place as the protector of the ring space." He swallowed the words. It was like another fine cut on his soul to admit that he wasn't certain. "I have no new security alerts," he said. "We see no ships on approach through the other gates and have no reason to suspect any interference from fringe elements. But if you would like, I will consult with my chief of security to make certain we have done everything in our ability to minimize your risk."
"I would appreciate that," Song said, and her tone meant, I'm sorry to ask it.
The safety of your ship and your crew are the most important thing, Singh said. I understand your caution.
I'll match orbit with the gate until we hear from you, Song said, and thank you, Governor. I do appreciate this.
He nodded and dropped the connection.
She didn't trust him. Of course she didn't. He didn't trust himself.
The Marines who accompanied him on his review of the docks were a mixed group, half of them in power armor and half in standard ballistic plates. Even if the underground managed to disable the power armor again, which Overstreet had assured Singh would be impossible, there would still be a guard ready to take point. Singh hated that they'd had to change their protocol. He hated remembering the fear of realizing his protection was gone, and he hated knowing that the fear would never completely go away. He still didn't know how the underground had even known the anti-mutiny protocols existed, much less how they'd managed to reverse-engineer them. Was someone a Laconian, a turncoat? Had they been careless? He had no way of finding where the information had leaked out. It was another little insult that burrowed into his skin. He maneuvered through the docks in a small thruster of compressed air. The empty berth stared back at him like an accusation. The pox in the decks and bulkheads where bullets had struck during the fighting hadn't been buffed out or painted over yet, though they would be. He felt the attention of the dock workers. They were, after all, the audience for this excursion, meant to see that the governor of the station wasn't cowering in his office, afraid to peek out from behind his desk, that he wasn't hiding in a public restroom. The heavy guard undercut the message, as did the fear in his gut. But he would pretend and pretend and pretend in the hopes that it would somehow become true. So he lifted his chin and made his way through the full round of the docks, even where the damage from the bombing of the primary oxygen tanks twisted and deformed the deck. He looked at the temporary plating with what he hoped was dignity and thoughtfulness. All he really wanted was to be done with this and back in his office. The acting dockmaster followed along just behind him. The anger in her expression was unmistakable, but he didn't know if it was rage at the terrorists who'd done the damage, or at him for not preventing it.
"How long will it take us to make repairs?" he asked.
"That will depend on the supply chain, sir," she said. "Once we have the typhoon, they should be able to get started in earnest, but they've been breaking more than we have the decking to replace."
"It's heartbreaking," he said, because he didn't know what else to say. She didn't respond.
"What is our capacity at this point?"
"It's not bad. The only berth that took serious damage was the first. Sheared off the docking clamps. Once that old gunship was out, the bastards took over my office. All the rest were released from the controls.
That's one way it could have been worse, I suppose."
What if he'd brought Natalia, and the monster had been here? Laconians had died in these uprisings. If his family had come to Medina, would they have been targets too? Would he have watched his daughter die the way he'd watched Kasich? And yes, locals suffered too, but to have his people dead and hurt, and with what repercussions? The criminals had scattered like seeds on the wind and taken his ship with them. What colony would see these images and not think that they could do the same? He pushed over to the broken decking and put his hands on it. He'd been weak before, lenient. He'd thought that by treating the people of Medina as if they were citizens of the Empire, they would be transformed somehow, they would be civilized. The decking was half a meter thick and twisted like a torn leaf. They'd been willing to do this. And he pretended he could treat them as if they were sane. Another of his mistakes. He had hesitated to wield his power before. And the universe had taught him what rewards hesitation brought. Well, he'd learned his lesson.
"Thank you. I understand now," he said, possibly to the acting dockmaster, possibly to something deeper in his own soul. He turned to her.
"This won't happen again."
This was what they were building toward, Overstreet said. The bad news is, they were by and large quite successful in their aim. I'm not going to make this pretty, sir. They trounced us.
I agree, Singh said.
Overstreet leaned forward in his chair and threw the image from his wrist monitor to the screen over Singh's desk. A list of all the people presently unaccounted for in Medina. The people that they knew had escaped. Or died.
On the other hand, Overstreet said, their objective was defensive. This was a retreat. I've had the technicians make a complete audit, and I'm prepared to certify that it's safe for the typhoon to make its transit.
You sure about that? Completely safe?
I think we've established that perfect knowledge isn't possible in this context. But in order to pull off this last series of attacks, the Underground had to spend a tremendous amount of its resources and capital on Medina. If they'd stayed here, they could have used the same knowledge of the station and agents within the civilian population to protract the struggle here for months, maybe years. Instead, they burned it all in one day.
So, this was a good thing? Singh said.
No, Overstreet said. But it was all the bad things they could throw at us at once. I feel confident that they didn't hold anything back. So, however bad this looks, and it looks very bad, we're going to end with Medina carrying a smaller insurgent population with fewer resources at their disposal, and the main body of the Underground scattered to the colonial systems.
The colonies, Singh said.
Yes. The loss of the storm, well, that's not inconsiderable. If we hadn't pulled most of the crew off to assist with other operations, or if your XO had scuttled the ship once it was clear they couldn't repel the borders...
Talk to me about the colonies, Singh said.
Overstreet blinked his two blue eyes in something like confusion.
Sir?
The colonies, Singh said. That's where the terrorists have gone. That's where the next wave of this will take place, yes?
That matches my analysis, sir.
So how we proceed here should be considered in light of the colonies. We should examine how likely they are to cooperate with the enemy, and how we can affect those decisions.
Yes, sir.
An example needs to be made. Something that not only restores confidence in the safety of Medina and the gate network, but displays what Laconian civilization stands for, what we believe, what we are willing to do to ensure our control over this situation.
Overstreet was silent for a moment. Singh paged through the lists of the missing, the faces of the enemy. There were pages of them, but not uncountably many. This was still a solvable problem.
What exactly are we willing to do, sir?
Overstreet asked, and his tone told Singh that he knew what was coming.
A white list, Singh said. I would like you to identify the people who we are certain are not involved with the insurgency. The people we know absolutely that we can trust.
And the others?
Singh closed the image down. The enemy vanished. An example has to be made.
Overstreet went very still. For a moment, the only sound was the hum of the air recyclers.
I see, Overstreet said. So, a step up from counterinsurgency.
It's been justified.
The official position of the High Council is that these are all Laconian citizens. That the terrorists are Laconian citizens who are also criminals.
I know, Singh said.
But I also know that I was placed in command of Medina to learn from practice what theory can never teach. And this is the lesson that James Holden and his friends have taught me.
Will you refuse to respect the chain of command?
Overstreet chuckled at that. Singh didn't know why.
No, sir. I will follow the chain of command, as is my duty.
Good. Please prepare the cull, then. I will trust your judgment on who best belongs on the white list.
Yes, sir, Overstreet said.
Only I have other orders, sir.
A thrill of confusion moved up Singh's spine.
Other orders? From whom?
Standing orders I received from Colonel Tanaka when I accepted this position. So, ultimately, from Admiral Trejo.
You see, sir, the High Council made it very clear to Admiral Trejo that the rule of the Empire is permanent. And if history shows us anything, it's that people hold grudges for generations. Whole societies have lived and died because of their antipathy born out of events that happened generations before. Or maybe things that got so mythologized they were just pissed off about stories of things that never happened in the first place. The Admiral was adamant that we hold ourselves to a higher standard, as we always have.
Overstreet spread his hands in a gesture that meant, "What can you do?" His right hand held a gun. Singh felt his heart catch, and then stumble like it was running down a hill.
May I ask what your orders are?
I'm to set an example, sir.
Restore confidence in the safety of Medina and the gate network, and display what Laconian civilization stands for. Including that we who have accepted the burden of government hold ourselves and each other to the highest possible standard.
Singh stood. His legs felt weak. This wasn't possible. This wasn't happening.
But I was loyal, he said. I've obeyed.
You've given me an order to kill Laconian citizens who have not been found guilty of a crime.
But, for what it's worth, I don't disagree with you. These people are scum. They don't deserve or understand what we've brought them. For me, I think they never will. But their children might. Their grandchildren, or their great-grandchildren. The story of Medina will be that Governor Singh mismanaged the station, lost his ship to a band of malcontents, lost his perspective. And, when he let his wounded pride exceed the mandates of the High Council's directives, he was removed for the protection of the everyday citizens in his care. You see the difference? If you kill an insurgent, you're the enemy of all their friends, all their family. And then there's an expectation, precedent, enemies for generations, forever. If you kill your own, even the highest among your own, to protect someone powerless, they remember that too. It sows gratitude. It sows trust. Generations from now, your sacrifice will lead to the peace, prosperity, and fellow feeling among all humanity. The air was gone. He couldn't catch his breath. His mind rejected everything he'd heard. He was going to see Natalia again. He was going to hold the monster in his arms and hear her gabble on about school and the dreams she'd had and whether they could get a pet for their apartment. All of that was still true. It couldn't have changed. Not so quickly. Not so finally. Plus, it'll put Governor Song on notice, Overstreet said. He stood. I'm very sorry about this, but it could be worse. You could be going to the pen. He lifted the gun. Wait, Singh said. Wait, do you believe all that? About what killing me is supposed to achieve? I am an officer of the Laconian Empire, Governor Singh. I believe what I'm told to believe.
Chapter 51 Drummer. It was 3 months before the heart of the Tempest came to the transfer station at LaGrange 5. People's Home arrived behind it, like a servant waiting for the right moment to bow. In those long, surreal weeks, the system had changed past all recognition. Or at least it had for Drummer. The surrender of the Union ships had let the EMC fleet follow suit. There were some signs that the Tempest had suffered from the pounding it had taken, fluctuations of its heat signature, a reluctance to turn to port, the decision not to burn at more than about a fifth of a G. It didn't matter. If Laconia was bloodied, it was unbowed. Drummer couldn't say as much for herself. A new armada of ships that had followed the typhoon to Medina paused there for less than a day before they burned through the Sol Gate. They were smaller ships, of a more familiar design, and fewer than a dozen of them dominated the solar system. The news feeds had nothing but the names of the new Laconian Protector-class destroyers. Daskal, Ackerman, Ekanjo, Smith, and their locations in the system. Where they were, and where they might go. Ganymede and Iapetus, inspired by God knew what quixotic impulse, declared that whatever the Union and the EMC had said, they hadn't surrendered. Two of the new ships had gone to each station, and the defiant announcements had ended quickly after that. The independent feeds that called out against Laconia grew fewer and more tentative. The Ceres station had a welcoming committee when the Ekanjo docked there, and pictures of the governor of Ceres shaking the hand of the Laconian captain became the iconic image of the moment, of the capitulation. Two smiling men. The end of one age, the beginning of something new. The ship that came to escort People's Home was named the Stover, and by escort they meant occupy. By then, People's Home had gathered back most of the citizens who'd fled before the battle. Not all, of course. Some of the evacuation ships scattered themselves out among the smaller settlements and asteroids. Got quiet, in hopes that with just a dozen ships, Laconia would overlook them. Maybe it even worked. For those who came back to the Void City, Captain Roman Perkins became their new leader. He was an older Martian man with close-cut white hair and skin the color of stained oak, with a folksy Mariner Valley drawl, kind eyes, and a fire team of Marines in power armor ready to make his wishes into law. When he'd come to her office, he'd had the courtesy to sit in the chair on the opposite side of the desk while they spoke. It was a small politeness that nailed in, as much as anything had, how utterly defeated she was. Laconia wasn't here to bully her or belittle her. It made no difference to Perkins whether he lost face before her. He'd come to take what he wanted. What he wanted was absolute authority, and he was going to get it. Gently was fine. Less gently was fine as well. The illusion of choice was hers. She'd chosen. House arrest was better than being in the brig. Her couch, her clothes, her files and access, though without any broadcast privileges and a Laconian sensor looking over her data streams. She dreaded the moment when Saba reached out to her and gave himself away, but that message never came.
She assumed that the detention and cooperation of the Transport Union president was useful to Perkins and Trejo and Duarte. Her confinement rooms, her escort to the gym, her meals delivered by Laconian soldiers were all part of the narrative of victory, broadcast through the 1300 worlds as a warning to behave well. Before Laconia, even the Union fell, even Mars, even Earth. What hope could any colony world have against them? That was speculation, of course. News feeds weren't on her diet anymore. But she could watch old movies, listen to music, eat what she wanted, play games, sleep as much as she cared to sleep, exercise her way through all the routines she'd told herself she'd engage with if she ever had the time. On the best days, house arrest was almost like an enforced vacation. For the first time in her adult life, she had no responsibilities, no long-term political aspirations to cultivate and attend to, no journalists or administrators or officials to spar with. The problems of who passed through which gate, of what artifacts were banned and which were taxed, of how to balance the needs of the colony worlds, all belonged to someone else now. Except for Saba's absence. It was the life she'd imagined retiring to when her term was complete. On the worst days, her rooms were a box of crushing depression and failure, and death would be the only release. Her handlers dealt with all of her moods with the same equanimity and insincere kindness. They were good to her because they chose to be. If they chose otherwise, that would be up to them as well. Her opinions didn't matter, unless someone else decided that they did. And she had every reason to believe it was going to be like this, her rooms, the gym, her rooms again, under guard and cut off from humanity, for the rest of her life. And then, 3 months after her surrender, the heart of the tempest came to the transfer station at LaGrange 5, and Drummer went with it. Vaughn came to her like a ghost from a past life. If she'd needed any measure of how her isolation had affected her, it was how glad she was to see him. His face seemed to have cracked a few new crags down the cheeks and across his forehead. He held himself with the same formality, but instead of radiating his usual low-level contempt, he seemed fragile, like bread that had been hollowed out inside so that all that remained was the crust. Or maybe that was her, and she wanted to see how she felt reflected in someone else, to not be so alone with it. He stood in the doorway while she gathered herself. "There's a meeting, ma'am," he said. "Admiral Trejo asked me to help you prepare." "Trejo?" she said. And it felt almost like a conversation they would have had before. "Is he here?" "More that we're there, but yes. The Secretary General, yourself, and Admiral Trejo. A few others. They didn't give me the whole list, but they seem to want you presentable. And there's this." He held out a hand terminal. She took it, spooled through the file trees it had access to. It was a thin list, but it had the advantage of being new. Things she hadn't already been looking at for weeks had a certain charm. A text file with her name. She opened it. "Note to the speaker. It is important that the systems outside of Sol no longer be referred to as colonies. In this and any off-the-cuff remarks, they are to be called planets or systems. No primacy should be afforded to Earth, Mars, or the Sol system." Questioner. Monica Stewart. Question. "Is the Transport Union cooperating in the transfer of control?" Answer. "The Transport Union has always been a temporary structure. Before our Laconian friends arrived,
We were already in talks with the UN and the Earth-Mars Coalition to draft a charter that would give over greater enforcement powers to a standing military. The Laconian fleet is the clear choice to fill that vacuum, and the Union is pleased to work with High Consul Duarte and President Fisk to see that trade between the planets, see note, is efficient and free. Questioner, Auden Tammet. Question. Is the Union ready to pay reparations to Laconia for the damage done to its ships? Press conference, is it? Drummer asked. That appears to be part of the agenda, Vaughn said. You may, of course, choose to deviate from the script. May I? But the Laconian censor will be reviewing everything before it goes out. And there are less pleasant accommodations than this. Drummer spooled through the script. 3 pages of questions, all of them staged, written, and approved. So, you're saying I should do this? You gain nothing by refusing. And there's a certain dignity in living to fight another day. Or just living, Drummer said. Or that. Drummer sighed. I suppose I should make myself presentable. How much time do I have? The conference room was the same one she'd been in when TSL-5 had opened for business. The vaulted ceiling seemed grander now than it had. The waitstaff circulated with flutes of champagne and hors d'oeuvres, tank-grown shrimp, real cheddar, dates wrapped in bacon that had once actually been a pig. The wall screens, with their views of Earth and Luna, people's home and the Tempest, were crisp and beautiful. High-level officials mingled and chatted as if the system of humanity hadn't been turned on its ear. As if history were what it had always been. The absence of a few, Emily Santos Baca, for instance, was something only she seemed to notice. The Secretary General was in a pale suit with a colorless shirt and a golden pin in his lapel. He was smiling and shaking hands with the people around him. She'd expected him to be more somber, but, in fairness, the transfer station had always been something of a humiliation for him, a place in the universe that defined the limits of his authority. Before, it had been her on the other side of that membrane. Now, it was Laconia. So, in a way, he'd already had more of a chance to get used to this. The man he was laughing with, hand on his shoulder, was unmistakable. Admiral Trejo was smaller than she'd expected, thicker about the chest and belly in a way that didn't speak as much of muscle or fat as genetics and age. His hair was thinning, and not styled to disguise the fact. His eyes were a bright green that would have seemed affected if they'd been fake. Trejo noticed her, broke off his conversation with the Secretary General and trundled over toward her. He was just the slightest bit bow-legged. Drummer felt an irrational twitch of betrayal. The man who'd destroyed and humiliated her should at least have been a bronzed Adonis, not a normal human being. It would have made it easier to swallow if she'd been beaten by a god. President Drummer, he said, putting out his hand, I'm glad we could finally meet in more settled circumstances. Just Drummer, she said, and found herself shaking his hand. I think we can dispense with the president part. Oh, I hope not, Trejo said. Transitions like this are delicate times. And the more profound the changes that are coming, the more important that it appear to have continuity, don't you think? If you say so, she said. A waiter slid by, and she took a glass. She didn't need the alcohol as much as the idea of it. But Lord, she needed something. I'm sorry your husband couldn't be here, Trejo said. There was nothing in his voice that couldn't just be a pleasantry, except that Saba's name had been linked to the embarrassment on Medina.
She'd heard that much before her detainment. She felt a thrill of fear now. Did Trejo know something? Was he about to tell her Saba had been caught, been killed? "I'm sorry, too," she said. "I miss him very much. But we have always had different careers." "I hope to meet him one day," Trejo said, and she relaxed a notch. He wasn't dead. Trejo saw her response and smiled a soft, rueful smile. "It would be useful, I think, if you could help to resolve things with him. Chaos is bad for everyone." "I don't have any way to reach him," Drummer said. She didn't go on with, "And I don't know what I'd tell him if I did."
"Fair enough," Trejo said. "We'll have that conversation another time, yes? Right now, there's something else I wanted to speak with you about. High Council Duarte wants to convene the important people in humanity's new endeavors on Laconia, a kind of permanent convocation of the best minds and most influential people. He's asked me to extend an invitation to you."
The politeness of it was foul. The pretense that she was still autonomous, the master of her own fate. Oh, she could probably refuse. Duarte seemed smart enough not to welcome people into his projects who were willing to openly oppose them. But there would be consequences. That they weren't even spelled out made them more ominous. "This is like the colonies, isn't it?" she said. Trejo lifted his eyebrows, answering her question with a wordless one of his own. "You're shifting everything to Laconia," she said. "Not just ships or money. The culture." Trejo smiled.
"Earth will always be the home from which humanity sprang, but yes, the High Council thinks that fetishizing Earth is bad for the long-term future of the species. We will also put in place an accelerated repopulation scheme, try to adjust the balance so that Sol System isn't such an overwhelming majority of the population either."
"You can't put billions of people through the ring gates," Drummer said. "It won't work."
"Not in our lifetimes," Trejo said. "We're talking about the work of generations. But, well, I was a Martian before I was Laconian. Thinking for the long term doesn't intimidate me."
A woman in a white dress with gold at her throat and wrists sloped by, nodding to Trejo as she passed. He smiled back, glanced at her ass, and then back so quickly it might have passed for politeness. "Your terraforming plan didn't work out too well," Drummer said more acidly than she should have. "It just came out that way."
"It would have," Trejo said, "if something bigger hadn't come along. Anyway, please do consider the invitation. The High Council is looking forward to meeting you."
Trejo put out a hand on her arm like they were old friends and made his way back out to some other conversations on his list. All around her, the eyes and attention of the crowd followed him and left her behind. She drank her champagne in a gulp and started looking for some place to ditch the glass so she could get another one.
"Getting drunk, Camina? You think that's smart? Or are you just past giving a fuck anymore?"
Avasarla was in her wheelchair. Her snow-white hair was pulled back in a bun, and her sari was a shimmer of green that almost hid the thinness of her body. She looked older than the last time Drummer had seen her, and she'd looked older than dirt then. "I am taking the edge off the pain," Drummer said, "because what else can I do?" Avasarla turned her chair and started off toward the podium and the seats. They were empty now, but the journalists were starting to filter in. The show would be starting soon.
"I'd join you, but they tell me I'm on my last liver these days," Avasarla said. "No more liquor for me."
You seem to be taking the conquest fairly well.
The fuck option do I have? Avasarala said. I'm an old lady who spent her life trying to make peace between Earth and Mars. All this shit? It's like I missed a day at school and everyone else learned to speak Mandarin while I was gone. I don't understand any of this.
Yeah, Drummer said. I can see that.
It's the reward of old age, Avasarala said. You live long enough, and you can watch everything you worked for become irrelevant.
You're not selling it, Drummer said.
Fuck you, then. Die young. See if I care.
Drummer laughed. Avasarala grinned, and for a moment they understood each other perfectly. For a moment, Drummer didn't feel alone.
Are you going to this orgy pit, or whatever the fuck it is Duarte's setting up? Avasarala asked.
Across the room, Vaughn caught Drummer's eyes, and began walking toward the two women with purpose. Drummer didn't want to go with him, didn't want to face the theater and falsehood of the next part. She turned back to Avasarala.
I don't know. I suppose I have to. Always a bad idea to ditch the Emperor, Avasarala agreed. Then, do you know why they're looking for Okoye?
Who?
Elvi Okoye, Avasarala said.
And Vaughn reached them.
It's time, ma'am, he said.
Drummer nodded and handed him her glass. Avasarala's claw of a hand grabbed hers, held her for a moment.
Chin up, Kamina. These fuckers can smell blood. And this shit's not over, no matter what it looks like now.
Thank you, Drummer said and pulled away. The seats for the journalists were full now. She recognized their faces. Sometimes even the way they sat, the way they moved. She'd done this for years. She'd never done this before. Admiral Trejo made some brief opening remarks, thanked everyone for being there, expressed bright hopes for the future, extended the greeting of High Council Duarte, and brought her up. The others would come later. The Secretary General, the Speaker of the Martian Parliament, whoever else. But she was the last president of the Transport Union. Her dignity was first for the chopping block. She looked out over the faces and remembered a time she'd enjoyed this. President Drummer, her podium identified the woman, Monica Stewart. Is the Transport Union cooperating in the transfer of control?
No, it is not. No, I am not. No, we have been conquered. But we will fight to the last breath because living with someone else's hand on our necks is intolerable, has always been intolerable, will always be intolerable. Not because of Laconia, not because of the Union, not because of any of the authorities through all of history that have made rules and then dared people to break them. Because we're human. And humans are mean, independent monkeys that reach their greatness by killing every other species of hominid that looked at us funny. We will not be controlled for long, not even by ourselves. Any other plan is a pipe dream. In the front row, Avasarala coughed. Drummer smiled thinly. The Transport Union has always been a temporary structure, she began.
Chapter 52. Naomi. Freehold was pain. Some days that was a good thing. It gave her something to push against, something to fight. Other days it was just wearying. The pencil-thin valley where they'd set the Rosie down had steep, high mountains to the north, east, and southwest. A thin creek ran along the bottom with glacier meltwater. Pale green, tree-like organisms clung to the stone with finger-thick roots,
and stretched out vines studded with pale green bladders that floated into the open air as if nature itself were putting up balloons for a party. A high breeze would shift the vines one way and then the other. Every now and then, one would break off and swirl away down the valley, maybe to die, or maybe to find some new place to take root. She understood it was all the product of evolutionary arms races. Photosynthesizing structures had spent centuries, maybe millennia, trying to choke each other in darkness, until one of them had figured out how to both be rooted and fly, how to both command the high air and drop everything below it into permanent twilight. None of it had been created with the Rocinante in mind. It just worked out well. The Rosie itself huddled in a wide space where the creek curved around. The landing thrusters had scorched the landscape around it, but it didn't take more than a day or two before the local plants began growing back. The fight for survival made everything either resilient or forgotten. The floating vines made a moving canopy 15 meters above them that would help hide them from observation, if anything ever came into the system to look. As hiding places went, it was decent. The colony itself, the only other 300 people on the planet, was in an arid biome a 6-hour hike down the valley. At least it was for her. The locals could make the trip in half the time. Houston lived down there, among his people, and sometimes she and Alex would stay there too. But most days she was at the Rosie, her real home. There was maintenance to be done, restocking, distilling the creek water until it was pure enough to put in the Rosie's tanks. The reactor could run for months without needing more fuel, but reaction mass was always a problem. If they wanted to go anywhere. If they just stayed put, well, less of an issue then. Today she'd spent half the daylight hours discouraging a cluster of very slow animals or possibly semi-mobile plants that were exploring whether the niches around the Rosie's PDCs would be a good place to live. When the light faded, she stopped for lunch. The planet's 16 hours and change diurnal cycle meant that most of her work days had at least half a night in them. The Rosie had been built to rest on its belly in a gravity well. All of her systems functioned, even at 90 degrees from what she'd become used to. That seemed right, too. Being at home, but also in a space her body didn't understand. Being in control of her day, but not of her life. Being achingly alone, but not wanting people around. It was all of a piece. If she dreamed it, it would have meant something. As soon as she crawled back into the ship, she showered. There were compounds in the life cycle of Freehold that irritated her skin if she didn't wash them off. Then she pulled on a fresh jumpsuit, went to the galley, made herself a bowl of white kibble, and sat. A message was waiting for her from Bobby, and she set her hand terminal on the table when she played it, so she could use both hands to eat. The kibble was warm and peppery. The mushroom squeaked against her teeth just the way it was supposed to. Bobby looked exhausted and excited at the same time. Her hair was pulled back into a tight ponytail, the way she wore it when she was working on machinery, not the bun she had for workouts. Her eyes were bright, and the suggestion of a smile teased her mouth without ever quite appearing. She looked 10 years younger. More than that, she looked happy. "Hey, Naomi. Hope things are going well down there. I think we're making some real progress up here. I'm not positive, but I think I've found how the storm manages its energy profiles. It's a little screwy, same as everything on this rig." I was wondering if I could get you to take a quick skim through the new data set I pulled. Maybe you'll see something I didn't. The embedded data was structured as environmental control buffers, and it was half again the size of the Rossi's. Naomi popped it open and glanced at the gross index. A lot of familiar parts, yes, but some strangeness in the large-scale structure. If it was anything like the other bits of the Gathering Storm's operating code they'd harvested for analysis, it would get weirder the deeper in she went. She dropped it to a secure partition in the Rossi and started unpacking it with her favorite tools, converting the language of the ships into something with handholds that her mind could brace on. She set her hand terminal to record. Dataset received and in process. It may take me a day or two, but I'll let you know what I think. In the meantime, all is well down here. No need for rescue. It was the rule. Somewhere in the message she sent up the well, there was always the word rescue, and always would be until she needed one. Bobby's word was progress. A message went back and forth every 24 hours at a minimum. Not that there was any real risk that Naomi could see, but protocol was protocol. The locals on Freehold had been at least willing to listen when they'd arrived with Payne Houston in tow, and there had been nothing but cautious goodwill since. Not that Naomi trusted that to last. The colony of Freehold would support her in her guise as a refugee and freedom fighter as long as it was convenient for them. She understood that having the only gunship in the system and a ring gate far enough away that she'd have a free hand how to use it for weeks before help could arrive figured into the local council's calculus of the situation. Bobby's improvised crew of belters were with her on a little moon circling one of Freehold's three gas giants, tucked in an ancient lava tube and showing no signs of mutiny. Bobby, as captain, and Amos as acting XO would, Naomi thought, be more than enough to ensure discipline. It also gave Freehold another reason to play nice, and a spare set of eyes on the ring gate in case anything nasty came through. The storm was slow to give up its secrets. Not because of the internal security, though that was an issue, as much as the profound unfamiliarity of some of its technology. Its reliance on calcium, for instance, was an order of magnitude more than Naomi had ever seen, and the vacuum channels it used instead of wiring still made her head ache a little if she thought about them too much. With enough time, though, she was certain they'd come to understand the ship. On her good days, she thought they'd be ready, even if she wasn't sure yet what they were getting ready for. While the Rossi arranged the data for her, and the kibble broke down pleasantly in her stomach, she lay back and let her eyes close for a few minutes. Her knees ached. Her spine ached. It wasn't even the gravity of Freehold. This world was smaller than Mars and only a little bit denser. She'd been on long burns worse than this. Part of the problem was that she wasn't doing her exercises. She was doing work, and there turned out to be a suite of small, neglected muscles that had atrophied over the years and weren't happy to be put into service clearing vegetation and crawling around the bottom of a gravity well. There was also, she suspected, something of a placebo effect. She'd spent so many years equating life in free atmosphere on a planetary surface with a constant grinding full G, that now, even though the gravity was actually fairly mild, she was primed to notice the discomfort. She expected it, and so it was there. The Rosinante chimed to announce the completion of the data run, and then again, almost immediately, to announce Alex's return. It was less than a minute before she heard him walking up the hallway that was usually the lift tube. He was singing to himself, a light, lilting melody with words she didn't recognize. "In here," she called as he came close.
Alex poked his head into the galley. He was more comfortable going into town, and the combination of long walks and sunlight had darkened his skin and given him his cheekbones back.
"Hola," he said. "Good news for